This podcast is in partnership with Design Biennale Rotterdam, Phoenix Museum, Lack of Guidance, Margreet Olsthoorn, New Institute and Rotterdam Partners, as they all share the common goal to create awareness, share opinions and empower creative growth.
Sometimes I know exactly what I have to do, but it just doesn't come out. And learning to accepting that as part of the creative process is one of the harder things, I think. Oftentimes, the fact is that a lot of successful people don't have something which is balanced. They go one way very hard, and all the other things suffer because of it. Reminding myself sometimes that comparison really is the thief of joy. Focusing on what you do have instead of what you don't have, I think, is a good way to live your life.
In today's episode, we sit down Said Kinos, a contemporary artist whose work merges graffiti, graphic design and storytelling into bold, impactful creations. We talk about his career, fatherhood, the role of typography and communications in modern art. Tune in to hear his thoughts on growth, resilience and navigating the challenges of a creative life. Hello, welcome Said to the podcast.
Thank you.
We once collaborated in a project in Amsterdam, and since then I follow you, and quite interesting to see how you on social media, for instance, talk a lot about your work and you express it, but that you also pay the attention to your mindset, your mental health, and for this reason I love to speak to you. Can you explain a little bit where we are today?
We're in my office, which is part of my studio. I have an office separate from my workspace, and this is the place where I do most of my drawing, planning, like my non-making work, I would call it. That's where we are. Here we are in Rotterdam, in my studio in Rotterdam.
Every guest I ask the same question. It's, how's life treating you at the moment?
Good. I always say I can't complain. I do complain from time to time, but overall, yeah, very happy. Tired, but happy.
Tired from what?
From everything. Juggling a lot of things. Personal life, children, work, being self-employed, all those things. Relationship, gets tiring sometimes. But like I said, I'm happy to do all of those things.
Well, let's dive into every topic. So maybe let's start with parenthood, because we initiated this recording a week before, and then we both said, like, parenthood, let's treat ourselves okay. And so how is this for you now that you have two children?
Yes.
And you manage with your ambitions and private life?
It's hard, but at the same time, it's not. I mean, I love my work. I could do it all day, every day, and I love being with my children. So it's, but the struggle is finding the balance between, like, having enough of a personal life that my kids know who I am and know I know who they are as they grow older very quickly, and at the same time still having the feeling that I'm working hard enough to get stuff done, or at least have my career move in an upward trajectory. And finding that balance is, I think, the hardest thing now. I set very clear boundaries for myself. So I work from 9-10 in the morning till 6 in the evening. And then, like we discussed before, when I leave here or when I leave where I'm working at the time, I try to go home and be home. So when I'm home, I don't do emails or whatever, unless the kids are going to bed or are asleep and I still have to do something. That might be the case sometimes, but I try to set clear boundaries in that respect. So the other thing is I have my children one day a week where I don't work on a Monday, and that did take some getting used to, just the fact that there's 20% less time in the work week. But other than that, it's great. I love it. Yeah.
Thank you. So, and just for us, how old are your kids?
The oldest is 4. So I have 2 boys. The oldest is 4, just started school, and the other one is 1.5. So he's starting to talk a bit, and very, very energetic kids.
Yes, we're exactly in the same period.
Yeah.
The mine are also 4 and almost 2.
Yeah.
So I can relate. So you inspire me a lot. And what I find interesting in this answer that you just gave is that you are also super structured. So in another interview, you presented how your workflow is with the spray cans and that you know exactly what to do next, your steps and so. So, but what I find interesting is with the creative mind and the freedom, you actually manage to do this between 9 and 6.
Yeah.
So how does this work for you and what can you give as a tip for others? Because I can also imagine that after 6 or before 9, there's so much going on in your mind.
Yeah, it's hard. And my girlfriend actually tells me the same thing sometimes, that I can be creative on call, you know, like when something has to be done, I can just go sit down and do it. But I don't think that's really the case. The thing is that I'm never not working in my head. So when I'm at home, or when I'm on the couch, or when I'm in the gym in the morning or whatever, I'm already thinking about everything that has to be done, or projects that are months away, or paintings that have to be presented after the summer. I'm always thinking about those things. So when it's time to actually go and make them, there's already like ideas formed, or there's already steps that have been taken in my head. So I know, just to give an example, there's an art fair coming up in Copenhagen with the gallery that I work with in September, and I've been working on location. I've been doing a lot of mural projects over the past 2 months, but I know that I have to make the works for that art fair. So in my head, I'm already thinking about, okay, maybe I could present new works on paper. I'd like to do new works on paper. So maybe how much should there be? Should be 3, maybe should be 4. Okay, 3. And then I'm already thinking about, okay, what should those 3 works be? So by the time I'm having a period in the studio, which is coming up like in a week or in 2 weeks, I just know, okay, 3 works on paper, that's what I'm going to start with. And as I go through that process, like new ideas emerge. So there's always, try to always be a few steps ahead of the actual making. And also what I've just started to integrate is a habit of drawing a lot. So I have a sketchbook at home. So when I'm with my kids and they're playing Legos or whatever, I'm often at the kitchen table just drawing, doodling a bit, having them draw with me, just for the sake of idea generation, just doodling. And 9 times out of 10, nothing comes out, or I'm just drawing like graffiti pieces or whatever. So just trying to have new ideas makes sure that when it's time to sit down and make the work, I have ideas. I don't have to think about like, oh, what am I going to make now? There's always already a plan in my head of something that I have to make.
Sounds like a very good way to avoid procrastination.
Yeah, and believe me, I still procrastinate. There's days where I'm in the studio where I know very well what I have to do, but it just doesn't come out. So that always also counters the point of, yeah, you can be creative on call. Sometimes I know exactly what I have to do, but it just doesn't come out. And learning to accept that as part of the creative process, that's sometimes the hard thing, because sometimes I leave here at 6 and I think, wow, I didn't get shit done today. Mm-hmm. Nothing happened. And I know I have to make 3 works on paper, for example, but just nothing happened. So there's days like that, and accepting that as part of the creative process is one of the harder things, I think.
For instance, today, you and I have this conversation. Afterwards, you were like, well, okay, that was nice. Let's get back to work. And all of a sudden, you feel like, oh man, there's nothing coming out of my hands today.
Yeah.
How much can you leave at the studio, and how much do you take from that feeling home? How do you combine this, and how does your partner and you together deal with this?
Well, my partner, my girlfriend, she's actually the one who tells me, like, listen, there's going to be days like this. Because she's always the first one to hear this, like, oh, my day was fucked. But I didn't get anything done, and it starts to like bother me, and I feel a bit like groggy about it. Like, it was a wasted day today. That's usually what I say. I wasted the day. And she's like, and then she's always the one that tells me, like, that's just part of the process. Next time, you're tomorrow or after the weekend, you're going to go back to the studio and you're gonna remember that the last day you wasted, and then you're going to have more sort of like energy to put towards getting stuff done. Another thing is, and I think this ties in with the how parenthood affected the work or the ambition, is I just need to force myself to be more efficient with my time. I know when I come here, like, I have to leave at 6. I can't like work into the night. It happens sometimes when I have like strict deadlines and I mismanage my time. I have to go home, have dinner with the family, put kids to bed, and then come back here, which is fine because it's only 2 blocks away. Come back here and then work into the evening. It happens occasionally, but overall, I'm just forced to be very efficient with my time. Like, I know I have to leave, so better get it done before 6, or get the part I want to get done, get it done before 6, and just try my best to do it. And one other thing is I try to batch tasks. For example, for today, we have a podcast interview, and I try to schedule appointments or non-creative work, so to speak, try to batch that all in one day. Usually it's Friday. So today, do podcast interview. Then I'm getting in the car to go pick up a new bronze sculpture at a foundry in Brabant. After that, I have somebody come to the studio again to pick something up. So it's all non-making work again. So just to have one day a week with stuff like that, like the mandatory tasks. And for example, if I know I have to draw a lot for new works, I try to do all of that in a few days. If I know I have to execute work, so actual painting, I try to schedule that in days as well. So I have days where I'm just drawing, just painting, just doing non-creative stuff, just admin. That way I know what I'm doing and I'm not sort of like jumping from task to task. So yeah, that's how I try to do it. That's how I work best or most efficient, I think. And yeah.
How did you learn it yourself? Or did you had a mentor or people?
I've had like not necessarily a mentor in the sense that it was spoken, but I do look at people who are further along in their journey. I'm also a bit of a productivity geek, so I listen to a lot of podcasts, read a few books on the topic. And I think it's also just part of understanding how your brain works. Just a bit of self-awareness, and it comes over the years. I mean, I've been doing this for 10 years now, I think. So you learn as you go, like, okay, this works for me. I used to have a lot more days where I didn't get anything done just because of overwhelm. I have so much to do. So eventually I got nothing done. So now I'm trying to minimize that, the amount of wasted days, by just applying structure, I guess.
Is that also something that you would love to give as a tip to other creative artists?
I would be hesitant because everybody works differently. Some people make amazing work just by showing up to the studio, having no idea what's going to come out, and they can get themselves into like a flow state and create something and then have a beautiful work of art by the end of the day or after a few days. That's not how I work personally, so I would be hesitant to give anybody a tip like, hey, this is how you should do it. What I would give as a tip is like, try to figure yourself out as how you work, ideally, how the best work comes out, and cater to that.
You're quite on the mental health, and you're quite aware of what it could bring if you discover a little bit more about yourself. Is it also that you spend a lot of time dedicated per week on this, that you say, like, I have a certain talent within me, I have a structure now, but it can always get better? Listening to podcasts, the interviews and such, is it part of your habit that it's per week that you dedicated the time in your schedule, or is it, it just happens?
It just happens. I think I just naturally sort of gravitate towards the productivity, self-improvement niche. So when I work, and especially with work that I don't have to think too much about, I can just put in a podcast and listen to things, and whenever something catches on, I either write it down or I try to really internalize what I just heard. And yeah, other than that, I don't really have time dedicated. Like, okay, Thursday is for training or self-improvement or whatever. It just sort of like slips into the cracks, I think.
How much of this, what you experience, how much do you consciously and unconsciously do you want to give to your children as lessons or experiences?
Yeah, it's a difficult question because I think now they're still so young that it's still very much focused on the basis. And believe me, when you would come to our house, none of this structure applies. Sometimes I joke with my girlfriend, like we're living in a toy store or they're living in a toy store and we just happen to be here. But, yeah, I mean, I think that the structure is also necessary for us not to lose our minds. So, and it's with kids, it's a necessary evil because they have to be at the school at a certain time. They have to be at daycare. They have to get picked up. They have to eat. They have to go to sleep. So the structure definitely increased or came about as soon as we had children, just for our own sanity, really.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel free as a person?
I do, yeah, because I don't even though I try to be as structured as possible and maintain sort of like working hours, there's nobody with a timer here waiting for me to show up.
Perhaps your kids.
Yeah, but not as when it comes. Yeah, when it comes to work, I mean, I do have deadlines, obviously, and I have clients, but I still have to show up for me. I'm the only one who's gonna know if I didn't show up here a day. Like, I mean, I could walk out the door, go into the city, go sit on the terrace with a beer. Nobody would care. But I mean, yeah. So I feel free because that's an option. Not that I ever do. But definitely feel free as a person, for sure.
I'm going to do some do or die questions.
Okay, let's do it.
Become the most well-known and respected graffiti artist on the planet, or from now on, sell out all your future museum exhibitions?
Museum exhibitions.
Never the thrill of doing graffiti ever again, or never do an art exhibition at a museum again?
This is a difficult one. I think I would I would not do the graffiti anymore because I hardly do anymore anyway. But that's, oh man.
Next question.
Yeah.
Traditional art tools or digital technology?
Traditional art tools.
Having unlimited resources to create any art piece you ever wanted to do, or have the ability to collaborate with any artist or designer you prefer, but they get the credits?
Unlimited resources.
Design a new, everlasting, and embraced font for the digital age, or create an everlasting virtual reality experience that showcases your current and future work.
Oh, virtual reality.
Last one. Lead a 6-month workshop on street art for underprivileged youth with an artist of your choosing, or design a one-piece public art installation for the main hall of the Tate Modern Museum in
Tate
London.
Modern.
For 6 months. Okay. Thank you. Okay, let's dive into a little bit more of your work. So you've collaborated with Denim and Fila, and you had a very nice exhibition at the Kunsthal Rotterdam Museum. What do these collaborations do for you as a career and a human being?
As a human being, I think it's nice to get recognition for your work. I think everybody loves that. And if they say they don't, they're lying. And especially when it's bigger institutions like the Kunsthal or Coda Museum, it gives you the idea that you're doing something right, you know, and to get that confirmation is very, very pleasant because there's a lot of doubt that goes on in the creative process, I think, for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Self-doubt, self-loathing sometimes. So to have an institution or a brand say like, hey, we really love what you do. Could you do it for us, or could we do it together? That's always great, obviously. For my work, I think one collaboration does more than the other. For example, the Kunsthal was really one of the pivotal moments in my career up until this point. Just because they have such a big reach as an institution, and there's just so many people seeing your work. They have a lot of commercial partners or sponsorships as well. So from that mural I painted in the Kunsthal directly came maybe like 6 months worth of work after. Others are more, you get the exposure and you get the credits, sort of like a feather in your cap. Like, hey, I can now say that I've worked with Denim or Fila or whatever. It's more a bit ego driven, but nothing really comes out concretely, but it's still nice to put on the resume, right? So, and again, saying it's always nice when brands like that come to you and ask you for your work. So I'm always happy to do it. And I think, I hope for many more to come.
Is it also that you're creating art, that you also have milestones in the future, that you, for instance, now this Kunsthal was very pivotal, that you have another thing inside that you think like, well, for me personally, if I reach this one, do you work like this? And you don't need to, but otherwise give an example what you think would be the next step.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I try to set goals for myself. And the whole topic of goal setting is a very complicated one for me, at least. But what I've learned through the years is that the best way for me to set goals is to set goals where I have influence over the outcome, right? So I can say like, okay, I want to have a solo exhibition or do an installation at the entrance hall of the Tate Modern, for example. I would love to do that. And that would definitely be a goal that I could set, but there's very little influence that I have over it. I mean, I don't know the curators of the Tate Modern, unfortunately. And for them to find their way to my work is something that I don't necessarily have a lot of control over. What I could do is say, okay, I want to create, in the next 5 years, I want to create 5 or 3 public works or works that have the same allure as something that would be nice in the entrance hall of the Tate Modern, and work my way to do that, or learn the skills that are necessary to get something like that done, or have my work be known for that.
Yeah.
So I have had goals like that I set, for example, okay, I want to sell 10 paintings this year. But again, that's something that I don't have a lot of control over. What I did find is if I make sure that I have a lot of output, that I create the best and the most work that I can, be as prolific as possible, then the sales are an effect or a sort of like, it snowballs into having more sales. And that is something that I can control. I can create as many works as I can or make sure that I do. And then, that's basically how I look at goal setting now. I would love to do a solo exhibition in New York or in Paris, for example, or, you know, one of the major art cities in the world. I would love to have my work in the Stedelijk Museum, Amsterdam. So of course there's things like that that are in my head, but I now consider them more like nice to haves, right? So it would be so nice to have my work in the Stedelijk Museum, but the only thing I can control is the work that I make. So let's just focus on what I create, and hopefully it will flow in that direction naturally.
Did you become a creative person and an artist in the way that you are right now?
Yeah, I think about this a lot because, like I said, I have had the the vanity metrics, I call them. It's like, okay, sell 10 paintings, make $100,000 a year, have my work in XYZ institution. They are vanity metrics. And like you said, once you reach one of those goals, you're probably going to think, like, as soon as you reach it, it's going to be like, okay, what's next? So I really think about this a lot. Like, what is the end goal, really? What is the end goal of being an artist? Is it money? Is it being able to buy a house or legacy? I think about legacy a lot. Like, okay, what do I leave to my children, right? And I don't know if I have come up with a final answer yet, but for now, it's actually coming back to, am I a free person? Am I able to provide for my children doing what I love, doing, like, creating stuff with my hands, having the feeling of being free? Because I also think that a lot of people who make a lot of money, for example, the vanity metrics, like, money is the biggest one, I think. And we all need money, but are the people who did make a lot of money always end up saying, like, the only thing that money does is buy you freedom, like the ability to schedule your own time, do what you want when you want it. And to a certain extent, I already feel like that. So I already accomplished that part of the equation. I'm not able to buy a house yet. So that's something to work towards. But is it the goal? No, it's not the goal. The goal is just to keep doing what I do now, hopefully a little bit better every day, a little bit better, and to show my kids as well, like, hey, there's an alternative path to being a contributing member of society without having to be in an office from 9 to 5. If that's your thing, all praise to you. If you want to work at a bank or at an office or an insurance company or whatever, I just know that's not for me. I just want to live this life that I chose for myself, how hard it is sometimes. But I think that's the most important part, to just be able to live according to your own terms. I think that's the good way to put it.
In 2020, you posted a message on your Instagram where you mentioned that you wanted to take a break from social media because you had worries about mental health and social media being a parallel universe and you're not really necessarily living your real life. But to hear this answer, because I wanted to ask, where in life are you? I have the feeling that you quite literally grew as a person, finding more relief and being in the moment, like, hey, relax. Because another one was that you saw a lot of other artists sell out all their exhibitions.
Yeah, I think that was just a more of an example. The selling out of the exhibitions thing was just an example of comparison being the thief of joy, they say, right? So everybody who does creative work compares themselves or looks at people who are doing similar work or just to say, have the same occupation as a painter or as an artist or as a muralist or whatever. And you hardly ever look back at the people wanting to be where you are. You look at people who are already further ahead in their journey than you are. And I think that's really, especially with social media, is a very dangerous and counterproductive thing to do. Of course, it's good. I consider myself to be an ambitious person. I want my work to get better. I want to improve my quality of life. I want to have the idea that I'm in a forward trajectory. But at the same time, it's more important to acknowledge how far you've come, what you're doing, the fact that I'm already living a life, I guess, where that a lot of people would love to have. So just reminding myself sometimes that, like, comparison really is the thief of joy, that I should look forward, should look ahead, but don't get stuck on, like, oh, this person sold out their show and I didn't, or this person gets to work for all these super cool brands or gets to fly all over the world to paint murals and I only did 2 this year. You know what I mean? It's just just more focusing on what you do have instead of what you don't have, I think, is a good way to live your life.
Yeah. And is this also something that you think about a lot? And for instance, your partner, your girlfriend is a very big support to you. Do you have the feeling that you want or need to support others, seeing that you're now at a certain level, you look back? Do you in any way feel responsible for your current and future generations?
If I'm really honest, I don't. I think I'm still very much caught up in my own career and moving my own career. And that's, I think, just the most honest answer I can give. I always find it weird when people come to me to and ask, like, hey, do you want to be a part of this mentor program? You can mentor younger artists and stuff like that. And I always feel very flattered that they come to me, or that they look at me as somebody who has apparently achieved some success. But that's not how I look at myself at all. I still feel like an amateur most of the time, right? I'm still trying to figure it out as I go. I still feel very much at the bottom of the food chain, so to speak. And that's maybe because I've spent a lot of time like looking at other people, how they do it, and looking at the greats, so to speak. Like, oh man, I'm nowhere near where those people are. And I think I've learned not to be that hard on myself, like having or judging myself for it, like not being there yet. But I definitely don't feel like I'm in a position to teach other people how this stuff is done, because I'm still figuring it out myself.
Mm-hmm. So super cliche, but you'll always try to figure out who you are.
Yeah.
When do you think there's a moment that you...
It never comes.
No.
No.
So there will be never a mentorship by Saeed Kino.
I wouldn't say that, because I do feel like you build up some sort of repertoire or like expertise over the years. But just now, I don't feel like I'm there yet. And to be honest, I did agree to do the mentorship program. It's from the Center of Visual Arts here in Rotterdam. And I mean, I have worked with, for example, an intern before, and I do feel like, okay, if somebody would intern here, I do feel like they would come out knowing more than when they would come in, but I just don't consider myself to be, a mentor just yet. I mean, I know some stuff, but I'm also still figuring it out.
Yeah. Well, personally, I think you'll be a great mentor.
Thank
you. I'll tell you more about it later.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Okay. So, when you turned 35 last year,
yeah,
you posted 35 today, nowhere near where I would like to be, but pretty damn well on the way. So much to be grateful for. Where do you want to be?
Yeah. I think that's what we just talked about. It's, of course, you want the vanity metrics.
Mm-hmm.
I also, like, I'm not sort of like an enlightened being or anything. I also strive to earn more money. I would love to be able to buy a house. I've already like very specific idea in mind where it should be, what it should be like, and yeah, just. Working towards goals like that, I think, is a good thing, but I don't want to get caught up in it. So, like you just said, there's a lot of things to be grateful for, but there's still also a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. How do you deal with, we just spoke about compliments. It's nice to have, but how do you deal with criticism?
Differently in different occasions, I think. I can not get up on certain types of criticism because art is subjective, and I feel very comfortable with people not liking my work because there's a lot of work that I don't like, and I try to not take it personal. But it's hard sometimes when it's from people that you look up to or want the validation from. So it varies. It's sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's, I don't care.
Mm.
And
what do you do when it's hard? What is
just
hard?
Keep working. I think criticism is comes in different forms. Like sometimes criticism comes in the form of rejection, right? So not having your work be included in a show or in a mural, a festival, or applying for a grant and not getting it. Those are the type of rejections that are not fun to get. But I try to, up until this point, I've never sort of like had myself be defeated by those types of rejections, right? I know that they're going to come. There's not a single artist in this world who never got rejected. Usually there's more rejections than acceptance, right? There's, you apply for 10 different things, you get 9 no's back. So yeah, I think I've, some hurt a little bit more than others, and you just sit with it, accept it. I mean, there's nothing you can do. I'm not gonna, yeah, there's a lot of times there's nothing you can do about it. Just accepting the fact, like, okay, this is the way it is. Just keep going. And it comes down to having a certain belief in your own work. Like, I firmly stand behind the work that I make. And once I don't, then it's time to make new work. So, yeah, just keep going.
What happened in life, for instance, that really made you more at ease with yourself and criticism being at you?
It's just life, I think, because at a certain point in everybody's career, and I'm speaking strictly about, I mean, maybe not even, just everybody is going to have to deal with rejection at some, in one way or the other, whether it be personal, professional, just going through those experiences. And I mean, the very first time somebody rejected my work, I can't really recall what that was, but I'm sure it bothered me a lot more than it does now. And just learning that it's part of the deal, part of the job, and realizing that you don't have control over it. You can be the greatest artist in the world, the best paid artist in the world, the most sought after artist in the world, you're still going to get rejections. So having gone through that a lot of times just makes the next time be a bit more like, okay, fuck it, move on.
You always take it a step forward, basically.
I hope to.
Yeah, whatever happens. And we talked a lot about mental health. How do you nurture your talent? Because talent is the start. But then it all comes. So, for instance, you have this structure of all the spray cans, and you have a data set of all the colors that you made yourself, and et cetera. Going a little bit into your projects itself, there's small scale and super big. How do you approach these big things? When do you have the feeling like I'm in control? And what do you do to prevent freaking out, actually?
Yeah, it's a hard question because to be really honest, if I'm making a painting on a A4 piece of paper or painting a mural on a 5-story building, the process is the same for me. It starts with a drawing. I draw everything by hand, whether it's a painting or a mural or a digital design, everything gets drawn in a little booklet. I don't necessarily think about scale that much. I mean, I do know that some things work better when they're big and some things work less well. And I think it comes down to doing the work for a while now. The work I've been doing now, I've been doing for a couple of years now, as sort of like aesthetically. So there's been a slight progression over the last few years, I feel. But it's the process has been sort of like optimized. It goes from a hand-drawn sketch to a digital design to a finished product. At a wall, it's transferred through gridding out the whole wall and sketching it on a spray can and then filling in big things, big parts of it. In the studio, it's making a canvas or making a sculpture. Perfecting the process and having confidence, like, okay, this process, I can do it now, gives you the confidence, like, okay, let's paint a 5-story building. The 5-story building, the hard part is going up, like the heights. I'm not necessarily scared of heights, but I found out recently in the UK where I was, like, as soon as I go over 3 stories, I'm not very happy.
Personally. I can recall because I called you and you were actually there.
Yeah. I mean, I try to power through it, like put music on, but being on a lift 5 stories high, it's not my favorite thing to do. So
so what happens if someone says, like, hey, let's do this wall, and it's
20 stories? I think I would have to really consider if I wanted to do it or not. I mean, I think eventually I would, but there's, like, I see people painting walls that are so incredibly big and they dangle in this little lift on the side of building. And I'm thinking, no, fuck that. I'm not doing that. I don't have any ambitions to paint like a skyscraper or whatever. So yeah, I think it comes down to the process, mastering the process. The flip side of that is that now that I feel like I've figured this process out, I get bored easily as well. So that's sort of also sort of the moment where I'm feeling confident, like, okay, I can do this. Give me a 4-story building or a canvas. I can make something that fits this context. The flip side of that is, like, okay, now I know how to do it. I try to kind of want to try something else now, like maybe switch the process, maybe switch the way I make the drawings, maybe see if the aesthetic can change a little bit. Just trying to progress the work in an aesthetic sense, that's now the challenge. And I think every artist has that. No artist wants to make the same painting their whole life.
Is it also that when you're wherever, a city or countryside, that you see places and that you're like, hey, I'm going to call this person who is owning the building or whatever, because I fully believe that, A, for them or the whole society here, and for myself, this is such a nice way to upgrade.
I've never done that. I've never actively contacted somebody like, hey, I want my work here. I do, like, if I in my car or on the bike around the city, there are some walls where I'm like, oh, that would be so sick to paint that. But it's always stays an idea, really. I've never proactively pursued any of those things.
Is there a special reason for this?
No, not really. Maybe it's being complacent a little bit. Maybe it's just being busy with the day to day. But I think it comes from a graffiti thing, because that's a place where you do proactively chase that thing. You're like, that would be a good spot to paint a piece, and then you go out and do it. Because there's no bureaucratic process that goes ahead in front of it. Because if I want to paint a wall legally with, like, a lift and shit ton of paint, there's so much that has to go into that process. And I think that's also a reason, because the process of arranging a wall to paint is such a pain in the ass. And there's people doing it. There's organizations, like mediating organizations, that take care of this whole process. They're like, hey, this is a wall we want you to paint. Come and paint it. The only thing I have to do is get there, and everything is ready for me.
Would you like to have, for instance, a headhunter? That not like a
wall hunter.
Yeah, a wall. Actually, yeah.
Yeah.
That not someone says, like, hey, we have a wall, we want you to do it. But did you say, like, hey, I just saw a wall, just get it for me. Get it for all of us.
Yeah. I mean, that would actually be a good idea, just somebody who takes care of that process. I do feel like, I mean, actually, that's not a bad idea. That would be a good idea. And for the graffiti thing, I think that's what was appealing about graffiti, that you just sort of, like, skip through this whole bureaucratic process and you just think, that's where I want to paint. I'm going to paint there.
No.
But yeah, a wall hunter.
Well, that's because I am at the first questions in the do or die, focusing a little bit on graffiti, that on one way during my investigation, I noticed you're so structured, but then you have, like, this complete other side, which is so free and spontaneous in graffiti. I always wondered, how does this work for you?
I think I'm a pretty impulsive person and easily distracted and very drawn to that sort of, like, freedom that we talked about. So the structure that we also talked about, I think, is more just to keep me from just fucking off all day and painting graffiti and doing whatever I want. I sort of need the structure to protect myself from that spider, sort of. When it comes to graffiti, I do feel like it's a young man's game, like skipping nights of sleep, being out in harsh weather conditions. Is something that's less and less appealing to me. The art form or the game, so to speak, of graffiti is something that I've still very much enjoy because graffiti is a game. I'm very aware of it, of what happens around me. It makes you look at your surroundings, your urban environment in a very different way. And it basically taught me everything that I know about like color and lettering and, or at least that's where I started my learning. About all these things. But like I said, it's very hard for me now with children to motivate myself to get out of bed at 3 in the morning to go paint a piece. It's a very good release. It's a very good release for energy, for just maybe random ideas floating around in my head or in my sketchbook that aren't necessarily applicable to the artwork that I make. I try to keep them separate as well. Like graffiti is really something different than what I do in the studio or even on the walls at the mural festivals, for instance. Graffiti is really just the act of writing your name in the best way you can on a surface. That's what graffiti is. And preferably it's illegal. So it's like on trains, on track sides, on walls where it's not necessarily permitted. But like I said, I don't have the possibility to go out every night to do these things. There's also a side of graffiti where it's just there's certain areas or certain places where it is allowed, where there's walls where you can just go paint and you don't have to think about the bureaucracy that we talked about. You could just go there, paint, take a photo of the piece, and then it's done. It gets painted over the next day or same day. So it's a good release like that. It's good to just get some energy out. That's usually what I do now, just paint a piece during the day with some friends, have a few beers. Yeah. And it's just nice to keep that sort of like spirit. I don't know if that's the right way to put it. It's good to I don't know. I still very much enjoy it. It's and I'm not saying that I won't ever go out at night again to paint a piece somewhere. It's just not as frequent anymore. I think that's what made it easy for me to answer the question, like, do you want to be the most prolific graffiti writer? I really don't. And I've never wanted to be because it takes a lot of time and dedication to become a very prolific graffiti writer.
Yeah, so I find this quite interesting because if you mentioned or if we mentioned the name career, then it can go everywhere. And there's a beginning, of course, but there's not really an end, or when you stop and you go with a pension. But you mentioned that graffiti is like a game. I never saw it as a game. I don't know, and I think people listening know what it is. What is the game?
The game is just to you create a persona for yourself and in the form of a name. You think of a name for yourself. And the game is to get that name as much attention and notoriety and reputation as possible. So the way you do that is to write it in the best way you can and preferably better than others. So it's a competitive thing, I feel. More places, more than the other person doing it, with better artistic quality sometimes. In the ideal world, you would have both more quality and more quantity than the next guy. So it's sort of like a race. And this is how I always explain it when people ask. It's like a race, but there's no winner. Nobody said like, okay, I won graffiti. Sometimes people like make a joke on the internet if somebody does something really good, like, okay, this person won graffiti. But there's only people who are ahead of the race.
Like reputation.
Yeah, pretty much. It's very ego-driven thing. And the sort of like weirdly counterintuitive thing about it is that it's only for a very select group of people. Because when I brag to you about, like, I painted 100 trains last year, this and that, you'll probably go like, I don't fucking care. It's only for the people who also do graffiti that you get sort of like these bragging rights, like, hey, look at me, I painted more trains than you did last year. And it's not explicit like that, but it's kind of like what's going on underneath the surface. You just want to do more, have it be seen by more people, and just get your name out there. Like, it's very primal thing. Like, if I would have my kids have their way with the crayons in the house, it would be on the wall. As a person, you naturally gravitate to writing your name on the wall. So it's very primal, it's very ego driven, and it's for a very select group of people. It's weird sometimes when I explain it to people like this, but it's so much fun.
Do you have like two personalities under one name or such? Because
I think one informs the other.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily two personalities. I think one wouldn't be without the other. So I wouldn't have a studio practice without graffiti. And I don't think my graffiti would be as good without the studio practice.
Because, for instance, if you would set the goal, like have an exhibition or masterpiece in Tate Modern, you mentioned that the game of graffiti, you as much as possible and super dedicated. Could you also translate this workflow, as you may call it?
Work ethic.
Like, for instance, chasing the Tate Modern.
Yeah, but I think then it becomes chasing the vanity metrics again. And that's what graffiti is. And that's why I also, like I've explained the game, I don't really play the game anymore. That's why I'm sort of like one foot out. I really enjoy just painting a piece for the sake of painting a piece now. But the people who are really prolific, they play the game. I don't necessarily I don't really care much about the game anymore. So I just paint a piece more for the artistic outlet that it gives me now. That's why I don't go out and paint 100 trains in the evenings anymore. I paint just at the Hall of Fame where it's legal, and I just paint it because I want to have a nice time with my friends, and I want to kind of make every piece a little bit better than the one I did before. But yeah, I do feel like the work ethic and just the DIY mentality of just go get it yourself, I feel that very much translates from graffiti to having a fine art practice. Yeah. I do feel like...
Did it help you?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's hard to pinpoint where exactly, but I do feel like it's just like a go-getter mentality, like making stuff happen for yourself or not, and also not being afraid of putting your work out there. Like some people, when they first start out, they kind of feel hesitant, like, hey, I made something, but I don't really know, or I'm not really confident enough to put it out there. With graffiti, it's like you're putting your work in the public space, and no matter how bad it is because you were drunk or you're not skilled enough yet, it's out there and people are going to see it and they're going to judge you for it. So I think that's that.
Who's judging actually?
What are graffiti writers?
So for instance, because I really don't know so much about graffiti, if I see many, it just becomes under the filter like, why did this happen?
Yeah.
And then I can contemplate about the positive things that you mentioned, because I really like when people are expressing themselves in whatever way. But I can also imagine the other people who think like, man, this was my building. Now I'm going to clean it up. So how much do you have the feeling that graffiti is contributing to society or just culture in general? Does it inspire people in a way?
I think it does. I think it also... gives people who are necessarily very privileged or very don't have very much access to the art world, so to speak, gives them permission to just go out and do stuff, even if the permission's not there formally, right? It just gives, it sort of like empowers people like, hey, go do what you do. And there's a huge culture and a history of this culture that sort of like validating you going out there by yourself and doing it. So I think in that sense, it can be very empowering. And it's also, I think it's a sign of a healthy city. If you ever go to a city and there's no graffiti, something's not right. It's sort of like gives or like dystopian vibes, right? I mean, if there's too much graffiti, there's a thing called broken window theory, like if they came up with it in the 80s, I believe, in New York. Like if there's a broken window and then graffiti starts to appear in a certain area, people will start to feel unsafe and it feels like there's no control in that area. But I feel it could also go the other way. If there's no graffiti, then there's maybe too much control. There's maybe too much of a sort of like big brother type of energy hanging around, right? So I feel it's like a sign of a healthy urban environment. If you go to all the major cities like Berlin, New York, Paris, they're filled with graffiti. And I think most people would agree they're thriving environments. So yeah, I think that's a way that graffiti contributes, or at least makes itself, like, carves out its own right to exist in a society.
And how much do you want or think your work in musea is inspiring other people? Is it needed to measure how much impact it has? But just doing for the sake of doing, I also don't believe that you have this. It's artistic freedom, but you also want to reach and inspire people.
Yeah, I think I could use more of the doing better for the sake of doing. When I make work in the studio, oftentimes it's already with a prefixed destination. So like we said, like I said earlier, the example of the art fair coming up, I know, okay, I have to make some works for that. And when I'm now going to make those works, I know where they're going to go, right? And I do very much feel the need now to just come here every day for a couple months and just make whatever comes out just for the sake of making. And maybe by the end of the 6 months, I have a body of work that I'm really proud of, and maybe there's nothing there, but I would have made 20 paintings that are now little steps that move me closer to a new body of work or a new aesthetic that I'm really happy about, new evolution or step in the evolution of my work. So I think I could do with a lot more just with the making for the sake of making. I'm not really thinking about how my work inspires others. I hope that it does. It would be very nice that if somebody sees my work and felt inspired or got the idea like, hey, this guy has a similar trajectory as I did, starting with graffiti or studying graphic design, and now his work is in a museum. That's fucking awesome if that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the intention necessarily.
Do, for instance, clients who commission you to do a wall in an office or pieces in a museum, do they explain to you why they chose you?
No, usually it's just because they like the work.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's, I think, enough justification to want a wall. And that's a super nice compliment always, of course. And that's what we said, that's the cool thing about collaboration, is getting that little confirmation that your work is at least appealing to some people.
But on your social media, it's different. So social media and the vanity of only success and imagery, but you still show your opinion about mental health and industry and such. Mm-hmm. Although clients don't do it. They just say, like, great compliment, please do it.
Yeah.
Don't you have the feeling then that you also want to know why? Seeing that you also support others who follow you.
Yeah.
And who are not explicit following you for the work. But for instance, me, mm-hmm. I like your work, but I like more what you're thinking.
Yeah.
That's why I actually follow you.
I don't really, I'm not really thinking about, especially the social media. I have such a hate, love relationship with social media. I try not to overthink it too much. And especially now, I'm actually trying to very much limit myself, the time I spend on social media. I'm a very easily distracted person, so...
You're doing it quite well today. This is a very good conversation.
Yeah, yeah, this is going quite well because my phone's off and on the table and I don't look at it. But when I'm by myself, I started noticing, like, every couple minutes, you just grab your phone and swipe through Instagram or whatever. And Instagram used to be great. I love Instagram. It's like a platform where I've built like a small audience for myself. It's where a lot of my work comes from, or a lot of the opportunities come from. But at the same time, it was really limiting my ability to focus and just like make the best work that I can make, because you're constantly distracted. And I think this is a lot of people are talking about this now. especially with Instagram algorithm becoming more and more like TikTok, and TikTok being the fucking worst of everything. Just the attention span of people are starting to shrink to basically zero. So yeah, really try to limit the social media thing. So when I'm on there and I do post something, I just try to come up with either like a witty caption or just the thing that I'm feeling at the moment or thinking mm-hmm. of at the moment, put it out there, and now just have a sort of like post and ghost mentality.
And why do you post?
Because I still think it's important to have an online presence as an artist. And I really wish that it wasn't important. I really wish that I could just be here and opportunities would come knocking at the door out of nothing, out of nowhere. But I think that's just not how the world works anymore. You need to build an audience for your work. And social media now is a way to do that. It's just putting stuff out there and hopefully somebody sees it. They like it, whether it's the caption that I write or the pictures that I post. And I'm sure there's people who do it without. And maybe I thought about like, okay, as a form of experiment, maybe I could just like delete it for a year, see what happens. But I'm not in that, I don't have that sort of like type of, I'm not that comfortable yet. You know, you need to be able to finance your life for a year. So if a year nothing would come in opportunity wise, that would be a problem.
Do you speak a lot with other artists and how they do it?
Not enough. I do have some friends that I talk to every now and then, but yeah, not enough. It would be very helpful to do that more often.
Because I see a book from Philippe Pantone here.
Yeah.
Is it an example of how you would like it or not, or that you ask questions?
Yeah, I did.
You know him personally?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. So we have actually met through graffiti. Yes, he's very much an example of how far you can take it as somebody who started from graffiti, transitioned into fine arts, and sort of like transcended that label of being a graffiti writer and now being a full-blown contemporary artist with a team of, I think it's 15 people he has now working for him. So he's an example in that sense, like, okay, that's how far you can take it. Like, if he can do it, I could probably do it. But to the skill that he's doing it at the moment, that's not something I'm aspiring to. Like, I don't want to be managing 15 people. I have no desire whatsoever. I would like to build a team one day to help me to create the stuff that I can by myself. But it would be very small, like three people, four max. I already have people sometimes helping me with the mural stuff. It's just friends of mine, basically, who I know also through graffiti, who I know they can handle spray can and they can help me paint a wall.
Nice.
Like I said, I worked with an intern 2 years ago, which was also very, very helpful or very productive. So I do see the value in having a team. And Philippe was definitely... is definitely an inspiration in the sense that he's managed to build like an empire for himself, right? Mm. Purely off the stuff that he comes up with as an artist. And there's a few people like that. You're going to have Paul on your podcast, the architect, and Sabine Marcellus' husband. She's also in the same category as Philippe, right? She built like an incredible team around her and she produces. She's so prolific. And it just helps you, with the speed that you are able to produce work and just the amount of work. I went on a studio visit with Philippe in Valencia a couple of years ago, right before COVID. And just seeing the sheer speed of which you can go from a prototype or an idea of an artwork to an actual finished artwork in a matter of hours is something that I can't do. I have to do everything by myself. I'm reliant on external partners who have to produce some works for me. So
what is the first thing that you say after such a trip in Valencia when you come home to your partner?
I have to work harder.
Yeah.
So I think that's the gist, or at least that was the gist of it. It was very inspiring, obviously, to see somebody who's managed to create that type of organization around his work. But it comes back to the comparison being the thief of joy, right? I can sit here all day and be like, oh man, I don't have a team. I can't create work this quick, this and that, and just feel really bummed about it. Or I can be like, hey, if I can build a team one day, that'd be really cool. Let's take the steps today that are necessary to get to that point in the future. And it's sort of like, again, something to work towards.
And I wonder, do I need to work harder or different? Because the expectations can be the same, but the roadmap towards it different. And a lot of stuff happened on my side that, and with you, for instance, that you say, like, kid goes to school and I have a second one, parenting, 20% just cut off. But the ambition is still there.
Yeah.
So if you keep the ambition, can you also, for instance, well, maybe not automate, but kill your darlings, or for instance, not delete a social media channel, but reach out to people and say, hey, this is where I'm at. This is where I want to be, or at least like a ballpark figure. What do you think? Ask advice.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And I try to do that, like, open to seeking advice from people who are further ahead than me. So that's why I did studio visit. I did, like, brought a load of questions like, hey, how do you do this, this, and this? And when did you start building a team? And I kind of saw with him, I saw firsthand how he did it, because I was also painting graffiti with him when he still had like a desk in his living room and had no team whatsoever. So that's the fun thing about social media. You can watch people's journey. But yeah, definitely there has to be more working smarter and working harder. I think hard work is something you're not going to take out of the equation. Everybody who's successful has worked hard, or at least has some sort of stable form of success, like not like overnight successes, for example. It's people who've managed to create a true thing of value for themselves. I think they worked hard, and that's no getting around it. Of course, you could work smarter and become more efficient with your time and apply structure and whatever, but there still has to be the hours that need to go in.
What I find interesting is that you say work harder, although what I believe is that with the structure that you have, for instance, from the 9 to 6, that is not per se working harder in more hours, but be even more efficient in the time itself. And I think this is very important for people listening who do admire you and want to follow you in the footsteps. That is not like reaching for a burnout or spending nights. It's automation and thinking.
It's effectiveness versus efficiency.
Yes.
Like, efficiency is getting a lot done.
Yeah.
And being effective is getting the right stuff done.
Yeah.
That's probably a Tim Ferriss quote. But it's having more focus on being efficient and getting the most out of the time that you have is definitely more productive than just throwing more time at the problem, right? So that's why we were talking about, okay, eliminating distractions, for example. Like me being here for 8 hours and being able to put 5 out of those 8 hours with solid work and being really effective is way more productive than me being here for 16 hours and sort of like half-assing it for those 16. I think that's just what it comes down to, and just being more focused. I think that's a big part of my idea of being productive is just being focused on the task at hand and doing as much with the time that you have within the time that you have. That's the way to think. I think about it.
Yeah. So do you consider yourself like a high performer and a good planner?
No, I'm definitely not a good planner. That would be definitely one of my weak points. And that's been the case since I was in kindergarten. I never remember elementary school, like the third class, I think, here in Holland. I would already get the term time management from teachers. Like, I wanted to do so much, and my mom would probably tell you the same thing, that I'm always, as a kid, I was always doing 10 different things, and the ability to manage my time is definitely it's definitely a weak point that I have now.
A very good point for improvements.
Yeah, for sure. Planning, yeah.
That's quite interesting, because if I know, probably a lot of artists, And by far, you have a better way of dealing with anxiety than.
I mean, I'm good at structuring my time, I think, but I'm very bad at making an estimate of something, of how long something will take, right? So, for example, I'm now working on a project in Delft, a mural project, public art project. And when I got the job, I thought, like, yeah, this is going to be 2 weeks. I've now finished my third week of work and it's not done yet. So, and when I say to myself, like, oh, that's going to take 2 weeks, after those 2 weeks, I'm already going to start planning new things. So what I need to learn the hard way is, if I think something's going to take 2 weeks, probably schedule 3 weeks for it and then some days, and then only after that time start planning new things, right? Because now that it takes longer, I have to reschedule certain appointments, or I have to reschedule this and that. So it's a constant work in progress. Mm. And I think I'm okay at scheduling, making the most out of the time that I have, but I'm very bad at estimating how long something's going to take.
So if you would have a partner in crime who does all that.
Yeah, that would be amazing. I mean, and my girlfriend helps me from time to time. But having somebody who would take care of my social media for me, I would like that. Or at least make sure that it's a steady flow of content being put online, and without me having to think about it, that would be such a weight off my shoulder. Or maybe that's all right.
Maybe it gives you time to focus on other stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Something less to think about, right? Yeah. And also the time, the planning. I mean, I like the entrepreneurial side of being an artist, like being able to like talk about financial structures and stuff like that. Just the non-artistic stuff I kind of like, but I would also like to have somebody else do it.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I'm in that place where I'm able to afford a full-time employee who can do stuff like that, I would in an instant, without thinking about it. Yeah.
Next to Philippe Pantone, is there someone else that you look up to, or maybe not look up to, but that inspires you in a certain way?
Yeah, of course. There's loads. I'm very fortunate to be in a position where a lot of the people that I used to look up to, and still look up to this day, that I can sort of like consider them friends now. A good friend of mine is a graffiti writer named Royds, and he is, yeah, I don't know, he's in a league of his own when it comes to graffiti and aesthetics and innovation. He's a true innovator of the art form in that sense. Great artist as well. So he's always very inspiring. Yeah, there's so many.
Do they have the same profile like you? For instance, I do the same, and then I always hear how good they are, and read the books and all the stories, and of course the challenges.
Yeah.
But for instance, now, really in the now that you have like, okay, nice on the long term, but I need to fix this, and I'm in a parenthood with two children in the tropical years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have people like this around you that you say, or wow, that person has
figured it out?
You figured it out, or that you're like with, for instance, Stefan Bontje, who is also on the podcast, also two children.
Mm-hmm.
You speak to each other like, we have the same thing. What's up?
Yeah. I don't really talk to a lot of people who are actually. But for example, I went to this festival in the UK last week or 2 weeks ago. There was also this graffiti writer. His name is Soffles, also like a legendary graffiti writer, one of the best to ever do it. And to talk to him about, like, okay, he also has children and he has a wife back home, and him juggling the same different things, the different aspects of life next to being an artist. It's always very cool to hear, and for like reaffirming, like, oh, I'm not the only one who has all these quote unquote problems. But yeah, I think that's why podcasts are nice as well, because you can listen to people having conversations that you wouldn't necessarily have a conversation with yourself, but hearing through these mediums that there's people that are either in the same point of their career as you are or further ahead and still dealing with the same insecurities, still dealing with the same practical problems. It's it's nice to hear.
Yeah. What tips would you give to other people? Because you
listen to podcasts.
Listen to us.
No, I don't know. Just the idea, like, everybody's going through the same things. Nobody has it all figured out.
No. Even if there are like major private things happening, like losses or burnouts, or is it then still? I've experienced those things, and I fully believe in what you say. In the end, it's life, and let's go there. But do you have tips because of your own experience that you say, like, okay, I know it's super difficult, but there's always sun on the other side?
Yeah, I think I'm very much a person who believes like that. And it's funny because you've mentioned now mental health a couple of times. If I talk to my girlfriend about quote unquote mental health or that I'm having mental health issues, she literally laughs me out of the room because I've never experienced depression or burnout or stuff like that. I can experience overwhelm and just having the feeling that it's all a bit much, but I'm not prone to depression. Luckily, I'm very happy that I don't, or very fortunate that I don't have that genetic predisposition to gravitate towards depression or burnout. And I think the burnout thing is just because I'm very much in love with what I do. I cannot envision myself doing any other thing. Being cognizant of my mental health is really just a matter of balance for me. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, balancing the work life stuff.
Well, that will be my next question. Do you feel balanced?
Yeah, maybe a bit too much at the moment. I do feel like there's a good work-life balance,
mm-hmm.
but that also, I don't know if it's true, but it's like a story that I tell myself. Like, if you really want to be extraordinarily successful, the balance usually can't be there.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be some sort of disbalance, and it's, I don't know if it's if there's truth to it or not, but I also listened to this podcast a few weeks ago, and they were talking about people always look at really successful people as having something that they don't. Like, oh, they have more work ethic than I do. They have more talent. They have more discipline. But oftentimes the fact is that a lot of successful people just don't have something, which is balance. They don't have balance in their life. They go one way very hard and all the other things suffer because of it. That's why athletes, I think, are a good example. I do try to look at a lot of, like, not just artists, but for example, I watch a lot of UFC, like a lot of MMA. And I think if you want to talk about not being balanced, I think those people are a good example, so to speak, because when they go into camp, they call it fight camp for a preparation for a fight. They go 3 to 6 months, I think. And it's training twice a day, watching everything you eat, having to do weight cut, being away from your family, training all these different aspects of the sport. There's no balance there.
Mm-hmm.
Everything goes into, and especially when you get to the super high, like the championship level fighters, same goes, it's not just fighters, it's like basketball players, it's football players. I don't think Cristiano Ronaldo has a very balanced life. Maybe now because he's already made his, like, he's one of the greatest to ever do it, but I watched the Beckham documentary, for example.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't have a balanced life.
Yeah.
So the truly great people don't have like more work ethic or more talent. They just have less balance and less ability to switch off. They're in their minds constantly working. So that's...
But then the question is indeed, and that's why I bring this up, is what is balance? Because I can imagine that a lot of people are really thinking like, ooh, I'm taking for private life or from work. It's not balanced. So it goes into the negative. Or if you like it, then you go into the positive.
It's also, it's very personal. It's where's your ambition? Where is your, when are you satisfied with what you're doing currently? That's why I'm always very hesitant to give advice. It's every person is different. Like, the ambition of person A and his or her willingness to sacrifice everything else just to get to that goal that they set is different, and maybe for one person it's easier than for the next person, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like me, I'm not very prone to burnout or depression or whatever. So for me, it might be easier to, especially when I didn't have kids, it was easy for me to pull all-nighters and to work 80 hours a week. It came natural to me. Another person might not have this privilege, so has to architect their way or their life differently to achieve similar results. So I think it's very personal, and I think it's very, because I'm now talking with my girlfriend a lot, like, okay, our priority now is the children. They're so young, right? The first son's in school, the second one's 1.5. When they both go to school, so that's like 2 years, 2.5 years from now, 3 years, say, that's when it changes. That's when, like, the one has found his way in school, probably he's going to be in school for a couple of years. That's maybe when we have the ability to maybe step up the workload a little bit more.
Mm. So hypothetically, and we can't, but it's because I'm experiencing it the same as you, and I'm thinking about this a lot. Mm. Like, what if they go to school? Then there will be more time for me to excel. So what if it doesn't happen? So what does this do as a disappointment that it still will be like?
I mean, yeah, I don't know. We'll wait and see. I've tried not to think about it too much. So I'm not like, it's also not that I'm like, okay, wow, in 3 years I can finally start working more, right? It's not like that, but mm-hmm. it's just as a sort of like path into the future. We think like, okay, if we want to at that time work more, that might be an option. If it's not, you adapt and you find another way, or you move, or you find another way, really.
Last topic. You started journalism.
Yeah.
I found it very interesting. And it was one of the first things that I heard. And I looked at your website, and it was not in the bio.
Yeah.
And I was like, why is it not in your bio?
I didn't finish it. It was only for 1 year.
I don't really mind how long it was. It's a choice, because there's an intuition that you want to do it.
Yeah.
But what I noticed in my own career is that whatever I did, and how long or finished or unfinished, everything at a certain moment came to a point that I was like, oh, I'm super happy that I did it.
Yeah.
How much did journalism do for you, and what can you explain to others who are now listening and doubting, like, I tried so many things, but somehow I have no idea why I wanted it. It doesn't make sense. Let's go to the first one. Why journalism?
Because I had a very romantic notion of me wanting to be a writer when I came out of high school. I had always had a fascination for like language and writing. I think it's because I started listening to hip-hop music at an early age, which is, I gravitate towards the more sort of like lyrically inclined hip-hop. So people really have a way of playing with words and like rhyme schedules and stuff like that. I wanted to be a writer, preferably for the National Geographic. And the idea was, I'm going to travel the world, going to write for the National Geographic, see all these amazing places. So traveling and writing were basically the main motivators for me, like, start journalism. I had a girlfriend at the time who was living in Utrecht, where the School for Journalism is based. So that was convenient. But yeah, after a year, or maybe somewhere in that first year, it's so general, that first year, because you get a lot of stuff, like you get history lessons, you get media ethics and whatever. And I thought like, oh man, this is not what I want to do. I just want to write cool stories or travel places and make reports, right? Do the really cool documentary style journalism. And that was not what it was at all. So it was maybe a bit of youthful naivete as a person fresh out of high school, but I'm happy I did it, because I think it's really important to know what you don't want to do, as well as what you do want to do. And I actually met my current girlfriend at journalism. She was studying the same, also quit after a year, and then we sort of like lost track of each other for years, and then like 5 or 6 years later ran into each other again here in Rotterdam. So that's and she's now the mother of my children.
Working with words.
Yeah, and I think that's still, yeah, that's still
often quite in your work nowadays. So yeah. Somehow it needed to be.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's all, everything, I'm not a religious person or anything, but I do feel like the world has a way of working out in your favor.
Would that be like for people who are searching, like, you know, follow your intuition and
Just
and
try things.
Yeah,
I think that's very important. I think I always did that as a kid as well. Just tried something, go at it really hard for an amount of time. Along the way, figure out, oh, this is maybe not for me, and then move on to the next one. Don't be fair. Don't be precious about it.
Not dealing with expectations from others.
Yeah, just go for it. Have fun. As soon as you stop having fun, stop.
Yeah. And you mentioned that journalism, you love to do it for the National Geographic and travel the world. So now you make art the way you like.
Mm-hmm.
You don't work for anybody else, so there's more freedom, so to say. And you travel the world.
Exactly. It all worked out at the end.
Are you living the dream?
Sometimes I feel like I do, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes it's more... Some days it feels more like work than others, but there's definitely moments where I feel like, damn, I should be very grateful to be in this position.
Thank you.
Thank you. Some fun.
That was my conversation with Siid Kinos. His reflections on balancing creativity and parenthood remind us of the importance of setting priorities while staying true to our passions. Siid's approach to blending typography, storytelling and personal expression show how he adapts in an ever-evolving world. Take his advice and use your work to communicate what matters most. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to click the follow button, rate the podcast, subscribe to the newsletter and spread the word so we can continue to grow the Don't Waste Eye podcast. And remember, everyone struggles and that's okay, but standing still prevents you from growing and reaching your potential. Keep moving forward because the better you become, the more you'll inspire others. Don't waste your time, don't waste your eye.